The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Well, welcome back as we head into hour two. It's a delight to have Sam Stone in studio with me. Sam usually joins us on Thursdays, but we had to juggle a few different things yesterday, so it's a delight that you could come in today, Sam. It's good to see you. Sam is a political consultant in town, among other things. He's also a radio host here every Saturday morning at 9 a.m., Breaking Battlegrounds, and a fun, active, and smart feed on Twix. Sam the Paul, Sam the P-O-L. Sam, good to see you, brother.
You too, Seth. It's been an interesting week here, hasn't it?
One could say that. Shall we get into it gently by starting on feline?
Do we do gentle here?
It's aggressive gentle.
Yeah,
what
it
I
is.
Want. Yeah.
Well, probably a little bit like petting a semi-wild cat.
Yeah.
Aggressively gentle.
Yes, it's aggressively. Probably, let's start there just to get a little fun. You and I have a lot of similarities and a few differences.
Indeed.
One of them is I'm a dog person, and one of them is you're a cat person.
That's correct.
I found a cat I could get behind.
I am the cat daddy.
Yeah. Well, I found a cat I could get behind, and I'd never heard of it until about a week or so ago, and it's – help me out. It's a
Savannah cat.
A Savannah cat. These things are cool as all get out.
They are awesome.
Tell the audience what. First of all, they can weigh up to like 25 or 30 pounds.
25 or 30 pounds. They are small dogs.
Yeah. They look like a bobcat.
Or
kind
small
of.
Cheetahs,
yeah.
I guess.
Cheetahs.
I mean,
yeah, baby cheetahs.
Yeah. So as I understand it, I'm forgetting what the fundamental breed is behind them.
I'll get it.
But it's one of the smaller wild cats that they crossbred or started crossbreeding with domestic cats.
Mm-hmm. The serval.
Serval.
Yeah.
Yes, that's
yeah.
it. Yeah.
yeah.
And you can actually, like here in Arizona, you could theoretically even get a serval as a pet. But that, to me, would be risking your life and limbs.
Yeah.
They look.
That's, by the way, that's how I found out about Savannah cats. I was teasing a mutual friend of ours who had a infestation problem in his attic with rats, and I said, "Well, get a mongoose." And he said, "Is that even legal?" And every state has its legalities of exotic animals you can own.
Yep.
Like in the Big Lebowski, you can't have, you know.
Yeah, in Florida, you can own anything.
Right. And I was looking at the Arizona list, and it said Savannah cats are legal.
Yeah,
a Savannah cat. What's a Savannah cat? Oh my God, it's cool.
So they're huge.
Yeah.
They're gorgeous. I mean, they're great looking. They are closer to the wild, and then you can actually determine whether you want a first generation
F1 away. Or F2 or F3 or, yeah. or F10, I think you can go to.
But once you get past about F4, they start looking like, you know.
There's no point.
Yeah, but they're kind of big house cats at that point, the way they look.
Yeah, we want F2s. We think that's the good medium, right?
Yeah, well, I think you do need at least that one buffer generation.
You need one buffer so you don't lose every pillow in your house.
Right. Well, and so you don't like lose a finger when it gets hungry.
Also, that, but you don't want to go beyond F2.
Because then they start looking.
You start losing the
They start
the
acting
part.
And behaving and looking like house cats.
Right.
I mean, they're just big house cats.
Right.
Which, you know, go get a Maine Coon. It's
right.
huge. And it's
right.
And whatever.
Right.
But yeah, no. So these things are super cool. There was a story. Gosh, it must have been about a year ago now. But one got out in a neighborhood in Houston, and the neighbors were all freaking out because they thought this terrible wild animal was on the loose.
Yeah.
And everyone was putting up photos of it on social media where they'd see it. And I took one look and I'm like, I want to drive there right now with a can of cat food and take that sucker home.
That's what you wanted.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, before I could even like get in the car, they had the thing captured, and I'm sure someone else got it. But
we talk sometimes around here about getting a station mascot or something.
That is a cool mascot for a radio
station.
Wouldn't
it be cool? And we could have it roaming around.
Yeah.
Cats are easy to take care of. The only thing I will say
as a cat owner, I have generally had, and it's not like by choice or whatever, I just sort of end up with small cats most of my life. right? Like little cats?
I wouldn't know.
Well, you know.
Like, I've never gotten the golden ticket to come dine at your home.
All right. Well, I did once have a much larger cat.
Okay.
Having an animal that does its business in a litter box and weighs more than about 8-10 pounds is maybe not the best idea ever.
Yeah. I wonder if you can train the serval cat, the Savannah cat, to use a litter box. We don't know.
Oh, yeah, you can.
Okay.
My aunt trained her cat to use the toilet.
Stop it.
She did. Yeah,
she got the picture of the cat on the toilet.
Yeah, no, the cat would go to the bathroom in the toilet. And you just like, you come in and there's the cat poop floating in the toilet.
Well, you're not going to get this on NPR. But it turns out
you're not going to get much of the truth either.
Yeah. Can we shift to that a little bit? That was a story of the week. And I was surprised how big it got. Bigger than I expected, the exposure of CEO Catherine Marr. And what happened with Uri Berliner. So Uri Berliner is a several decades long employee of NPR, reporter journalist at NPR, who is a liberal leftist and deigns to write a piece for the Free Press about the bias at NPR and how it would always
87 Democrats or you know, technically independents or whatever, but zero Republicans in their editorial staff.
And how they killed stories that were
damaging
to the left or helpful to the right.
Yeah.
And he gets suspended.
Which,
and then he says,
I'm actually of two minds about a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, because he did violate his contract by going to the FP, but they never would have let him print this with NPR.
Right.
So, yeah, the organization actually probably had a right to fire him.
Of course.
But at the same time, the fact that they're so reflexively quick to do that, instead of to consider why this guy who's been a loyal employee and loyal just loyal citizen of journalism for 25 years had to go to another institution to make his voice heard. And there's zero consideration of what that actually means at NPR. Instead, they just get rid of him.
That's a huge element. And then the secondary element that comes from that is the notion that NPR would fire him for expressing his point of view. Now, yes, the right to do so is inherent, but the idea that journalists are now firing journalists for speaking out, this industry that wraps itself in the First Amendment, anytime you want to ask them a question about their practices or their confidential informants or where they got classified intel that they leaked during wartime or any number of things you want to ask them about, even if it has to do with slander or libel, they wrap themselves in First Amendment absolutism. We have the right to say and speak anything we want. No other industry or profession says it as much as they do. And here's an example of a guy getting fired for merely speaking his mind.
Oh, absolutely.
It's really interesting. It's the way they all kind of acted with the New York Post on the Hunter Biden story. They were all happy to help censor a fellow newspaper.
Right. Absolutely. And there's another element to this, which is this Catherine Mayer.
Yeah. We have a lot to say about
She's not a journalist. Let's just start right there. The head of NPR is not a journalist. She came from the NGO world, non-governmental organizations, mostly overseas. She's doing work with the EU and all this stuff. Then at Wikimedia, Wikipedia's parent company, where her goal was, as she said on video.
Right. At a TED Talk.
Not about the truth.
Right. She said, I wrote it down. Yeah, that's exactly right. The truth is not always the best place to start in journalism.
Right.
Truth is not the greatest place to start, she said.
Right.
Unbelievable.
That is exactly the opposite of journalism.
Right.
The truth is the only place to start if you're actually a journalist.
Right.
But what this details is that so many are not. The other element to this, and we can get into more of her, because boy, is she a fount of...
There's a treasure trove of nonsense.
But... you know, there was a tweet I saw yesterday by Mark Andreessen, the venture capitalist, where he said the misperception is that Catherine Mayer is unusual.
Right.
He said, I deal with hundreds of her every single week. They're in every boardroom. They're in every charitable organization. They are running the bureaucratic empires. And he, you know, basically just pointing to her as an avatar for what this and that rings very true. because otherwise, why would she have ever gotten this position?
Well, it
you
explains
almost
a lot
have
of,
to be an avatar it, of this it ex- garbage.
It explains a lot of the journalism that we have lamented for the last 20 years, and certainly you and I together on this show or on your own show. It explains it. It is the attitude. Yeah. It's the attitude at the journalism schools. It's the attitude at the Cronkite School. It's the attitude probably at almost every journalism school in the country. It's no longer about the journalist's oath anymore.
No, it is absolutely an ideological platform and not a truth platform anymore.
Let me pick up on that with you when we come back. Sam Stone is my guest. He and I will be right back. Follow him on Twitter, X, Twix, at Sam the Paul. Listen to his show, Breaking Battlegrounds, every Saturday at 9 a.m. right here on KKNT. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. We're coming in with my single favorite greatest song in my mind, or my single favorite song.
Is that
Crosby,
your favorite
Stills,
song?
It is. Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Yeah, of course it is. It's the Southern Cross. I just love that song. Bill asked me a question. Mr. Bill asked me a question, Sam. I throw it at you. Do you think you've heard the best song you will ever hear? Now, I used to have an answer to that question with a Jay Ferguson song called Thunder Island, until I heard this song from the album Daylight Again, The Southern Cross, and now it is that one is my favorite song. I don't think I can ever see an improvement.
Well, I guess let's answer that question in two ways.
Yeah.
Right? For one thing, I always used to wonder growing up why my father was so obsessed with music from the 30s, 40s, and whatever. Uh-huh. It's because that's when he came of age, right?
Yeah.
So to some extent, the music that you come of age with will always be at the top of your list.
Sure.
I think in this current case, and not to bag on modern society all the time too much, but there are so many elements of great musical talent and musicianship that are not as prevalent in society as they once were. And I think you and I have talked about this a little bit, but like – it used to be half of America had training in musical training via church.
Yeah,
right?
Right.
Singing, playing instruments, all these kinds of things. And if you look at the history of American rock and roll, it really came from the churches.
Yes, of course.
Whether they rejected the teachings of the church or not, but they learned the skills there and developed them. It's a little bit like for one of the things, I'm a huge basketball fan, as you know. Basketball, the depth of talent is vastly different today because you have the entire population basically of the world playing basketball, right?
Right.
So as opposed to 30 years ago when it was the population of one country, the pool of talent is that much greater. We have shrunk the pool of talent. And the type of music that gets produced, which is electronically you know, controlled and modified and all this kind of thing, doesn't lend itself to artistic musical greatness in the same way that playing an instrument does. And so my answer is yes, I've heard the greatest song I will ever hear, but I hope like heck I'm wrong.
Do you have a nomination for it in your own head?
So, yeah, you're not going to like it.
No, I probably won't.
Oh, you know, you'll hate it.
I'm sure.
You'll hate it.
Go
but
ahead.
For me, Enter Sandman. I am a 90s hard rock guy.
More Mr. Bill than me.
See?
Yeah.
Yeah. I am a 90s hard rock guy, okay?
Fine.
I mean, that's just what it is.
Fine.
But the story that's being told in that song.
Thus concludes our interview with Sam Stone. 602,
if any. We'll never be allowed back on the air again.
No, it's a perfectly fine song. It's just
I wish it
on the ladder of great music.
I wish it hadn't been overplayed as much as it has.
I know, I know.
And actually, let me – so – One, which is the other song I put up there from them, if it didn't intersperse the audio from the little movie that they did, it would be at the top of my list. But that detracts from the music.
Yeah, sure, sure.
So
I take the point. I heard the other day they're doing or they're redoing or sequeling Spinal Tap. They're doing a sequel or a redo of Spinal Tap.
Really?
That's what I heard, yeah, on the Adam Carolla show, which let's hope it works. I mean, that's a high-risk proposition.
I have this thing because you got the new version of The Crow coming out.
Yeah.
And I truly don't think you can make a better movie for what it was than the original Crow.
Okay.
I think that was a brilliant film. it's actually held up better. It plays better in some ways now than it did when it came out.
Yeah, interesting.
I really dislike it when they try to remake things that are actual masterpieces.
Yeah. There's not a lot of examples of remakes that were better. I can think of maybe two. Maybe A Star Is Born.
Yeah.
Which there were, I think, three or four iterations. And maybe The Great Gatsby. Maybe. Of which there were three, I think, right?
Yeah, I think that's true.
After that, it's downhill.
Yeah, there's very, very few that I put up there. I'd actually put the most recent, The Dune.
Uh-huh.
I'd put that
okay.
as having – the first one was brilliant yeah. in concept, yeah. but I think time-wise, the yeah. technology hadn't gotten there.
Sequels are equally difficult to recapture – Rebottle the Lightning.
Equally,
only one I can
equally
think of.
Difficult. The Thomas Crown Affair.
Yeah. Oh, that's a remake. That's a pretty good one.
The first one was fine.
Yeah.
It was
the second
good.
One's pretty
the Pierce Brosnan
yeah.
remake
yeah.
was brilliant.
It was really good. Rene,
he and Rene Russo were
it was magic.
Off the charts yeah. great in
I
that
agree
film.
With you about that. Sequels, I think the only two I would really go with are well, The Godfather 2, I think most film critics will say The Godfather 2 might have been more artistic.
It's the best of the trilogy yeah, by yeah. far. I mean, the first one
it's great.
Great. The yeah. second one is
better,
world class. Yeah. The third one, just don't
yeah.
do it.
I think Lethal Weapon 2 was pretty good.
It was really good, yeah.
And then there was one other, Die Hard 2.
Beverly Hills Cop 2 was actually, yeah, I thought, yeah. just as good as the
yeah,
original.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Those are the ones.
There's some of that, right?
Very few.
And remakes are especially deadly to me. If
yeah.
if yeah. it was great. Remake stuff that should have been great and wasn't.
I know. But it's a problem with Hollywood that's all they're doing now is remakes.
It's a huge problem. You know, I was thinking
it shows the lack of creativity a little bit, I
yeah,
think.
I was thinking about this in relation to you know, sort of all the whitewashing that's going
yeah,
on
yeah,
in
yeah.
stories,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I'm forgetting the name. You have your computer in front of me, but there was the former slave who escaped, stole a warship in the Civil War, stole a warship, sailed it past the Southern blockade, joined the Northern U.S. Army Navy.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a commissioned officer.
Robert Smalls. Yeah.
Robert Smalls is one of the great untold movie stories in history.
Sure.
So why the heck do I have to get a Captain America, who's black, instead of telling me the bloody story of Robert Smalls, who, by the way, is one of the greatest Americans in history and whose story has not been told in a way that honors his legacy in film. So there's so many great stories like that. As someone who we've talked about, I'm really big on reading histories of the Middle East, the Silk Road, that sort of thing. They're incredible stories.
Oh, there's millions of movies in every yeah, one of those stories.
But that have nothing to do with any white people.
Right.
So tell those stories.
Right.
I don't care if there's a single white person inside in anyone. Just tell it honestly.
Right.
Instead, I've got people you got people complaining about Shogun not having black people in it. I'm like, you know, they killed all the sailors who washed up on the shore. Like, the entire point of the story is they didn't kill this white guy.
I want to come back to NPR with you when we come right back. And then we'll say a word about Iran and Israel and the Middle East, since you're an expert on that as well. Sam Stone is my guest. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Sam Stone is my guest, political consultant and town radio host himself, breaking battlegrounds every Saturday at 9 a.m. here on KKNT. 960. Sam, circle back. We had a little bit of a cultural interstice there. Let's go back to Catherine Marr, the CEO of NPR, for a second, because she said something. The person you were quoting, I'm sorry, who'd you say you were quoting? Andreessen was saying how emblematic she is of so many people in her position. He's absolutely right. When she said on her quote that the truth is not the greatest place to start, she went further to say, because it can sometimes get in our way
yes.
of what we are here to accomplish. So they are now
advocacy organizations. They're not reporting organizations. They want to shape the story. But then she went even further yet in saying, and the reason it's hard to start with the truth is that we all have our own truths. Well, yes, if you have newspapers that don't start with the truth. You
right.
have a million different versions
yes.
of truth. You can say things like Israel commits genocide. Well, that's your truth. You can say I am a leaf. Well, that's my truth.
We have a story I saw yesterday about a bunch of middle school furries running around in Utah barking.
It's their truth.
Like, you know.
You can't deny their truth.
Yeah, biting other kids,
right.
And that's okay because that's their
that's
truth.
That's who they are, yeah. They're Savannah cats.
Right.
Yeah.
It's too bad they're not Savannah cats because then they might even
I'd affirm it.
Yeah.
But that's what, but what she's inviting us into with this philosophy, what I think is emblematic of so much of journalism, what they're inviting us into is to anarchy. We will no longer have even a common language anymore. We won't even know the difference. I mean, we have Supreme Court justices that don't know the difference between a man and a woman and won't say they know the difference. They won't even say they know the difference.
Well, they
we
do know the difference.
Know what a table
I think
is.
The problem is that it's a little bit like what you heard from Soviet dissidents in the behind the Iron Curtain is you're sitting there forced to espouse things that you know are deeply untrue.
Correct.
But you do so because it's advantageous to you. And that, I think, is the central issue of who a Catherine Marr is this is a person who has no actual – I mean, what actual value set do they have? What sort of moral framework do they exist in? Everything we've seen of her suggests that she lives in a framework where whatever is the trope of the day on the left is her moral framework, and whatever the right is doing at the same time – is immoral by her. There really is – you can't have truth without an acceptance of reality.
Right.
And these folks don't accept reality. I mean, this woman literally is a parody of Titania McGrath, which is a parody account on Twitter. Like,
correct.
If I was trying to create a parody account of Titania McGrath,
right.
It's Catherine Marr.
It's a good point. And it's a good point what you said about the totalitarian regimes that force you – well, that engage in forced confessions about things that you know are not the truth and they know are not the truth.
Yeah, the struggle sessions, which,
correct.
By the way, we're seeing here in U.S. schools.
Right.
They're calling parents in for struggle sessions over their kids' behavior. What not? I mean,
well, we've unlearned a lot. So one of my favorite quotes, one of my favorite people in the 20th century – was Vaclav Havel, who was a great Czech writer who was imprisoned by the Soviets and then ultimately became the president of the Czech Republic once it broke free and once the Soviet Union crumbled. And he has this line all about, you know, what you have to do to get along in these societies. He has this wonderful essay in 1978 where he talks about the greengrocer, just any merchant, mm-hmm. and he has to hang a sign in his window, "Workers of the World Unite." He may or may not believe it. He just knows he has to hang it there because that's the price of existing peacefully. He says, if the main pillar of the system is living a lie, then it is not surprising that the fundamental threat to it is living the truth. This is why it must be suppressed more severely than anything else. NPR. Vaclav Havel on NPR.
That's exactly.
Might as well be is my point.
Yeah. No, that's – what's interesting, too, about that point is when you listen to, like, the things she said, some of the clips, she's not actually saying anything.
I know. That's the other thing.
She's just repeating a bunch of formulas.
Yeah. It's a word salad.
Yeah.
That you could – you know what we need to do? Mr. Bill did me a favor once. He took a bunch of Oprah Winfrey's writings and Kamala Harris' speeches and didn't tell me who said what, and the game was to figure out, because we ought to add – we should add Catherine Marr and play the game. I did pretty well. I was able to – I did pretty well in figuring out who was who. But these are just words – these are just words picked out randomly, thrown together into a sentence.
I mean, it's one one genuflection after another at the altar of leftism.
Exactly right. Let's talk about the Middle East for a second when we come back. Yep.
Yeah.
Sam Stone's my guest. We'll be right back.
In the sky.
Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Sam Stone is my guest. Follow him on Twitter, X, Twix, at Sam the Paul. It was speculated all week long if Israel would do anything in retaliation for the salvo, the fusillade that Iran launched earlier against it, the 300 rockets that Iran launched at Israel. And the debate was, should Israel do anything? And if it does, what will it do? We got the answer, I think, last night. And maybe it's the final answer. Israel did a limited strike that took out the air defense systems of Iran, one of Iran's nuclear facilities. I take it to send the message that said, you're touchable. Remember the movie Untouchables?
Yes.
Touchable.
Yes.
You are touchable. We can do this. And stay down. Stay calm. This
right.
Do no more or we'll go further.
It was very limited response, as these things go. You know, my problem with it is I don't think you can really treat Iran as a normal state in any sense of the word. So, for instance, everyone's saying it's this huge diplomatic violation to have targeted an Iranian general who was involved in procuring supplies and weapons for terrorists around the globe while he's sitting in an embassy in Damascus. Well, that presumes that Iran's embassies are embassies like anyone else's, as opposed to, yeah, they may serve the visa capacity that others do, but they are essentially terrorist funding, organizing, and control points.
When you turn a mosque or a school or a hospital into a weapons battalion or a missile launching site, it is no longer a mosque or a hospital or a school.
And it's
the same is true of diplomatic entities,
yes.
Diplomatic physical housing. The man was the head of a terrorist organization listed as a terrorist organization.
Yes. There's a reason, for instance, like let's say in Iraq, right, where the U.S. has been engaged for quite some time. There is a military headquarters and then there's our embassy and they're not the same thing.
Right. Because we distinguish, by the
yeah,
way.
Yeah, because one right. – one
normal countries distinguish.
Normal countries distinguish, and one is in a conflict a legitimate target
mm-hmm.
and one is not.
Correct.
But when you treat them the same,
yep.
then they are.
Yep.
And look, fundamentally – nobody wants to be – even the Israelis in our side here in the United States, we're not honest about what's really going on with this.
Right.
And there's no solution, no long-term solution without that honesty.
Correct. Do
which
it.
Which is this. Jihadist, fundamentalist Islam is incompatible with modern humanitarian values.
Correct.
Completely incompatible.
Correct.
And the West, Israel, other countries, we cannot solve this problem. If you are a Muslim and you do not want to see any more innocent civilians, Muslim civilians killed, the answer is really, really simple and clear. You take the terrorist elements in your society and you push them out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You push them out on their own so that that missile strike just hits them.
Mm-hmm.
And if they try to bury themselves under your school, your hospital, or hide behind the skirts of your women, you deal with them yourself
mm-hmm.
and you kill them
mm-hmm.
and get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
That's how this ends.
Mm-hmm.
That is the only way this conflict ends.
This has been the work of our friend Zudi Jasser for many, many years.
Yes.
About the necessary reform that needs to take place in Islam to rid itself of that Islamofascism.
It is the only answer. It is the only thing that will solve the issue for all time. Religions should compete on the field of ideas and beliefs and in the hearts and minds of people. They should not compete in gun barrels.
I agree. And nicely stated and clearly stated. And that's what's missing in this debate, the clarity of this and the lack of knowledge about the history of what's going on here. You're a history buff and you read history on the Middle East amongst other areas. The history of this is the proof of your point. Those who know whose history runs a little bit further than yesterday will know that Jews were being slaughtered in what was then called Palestine in the 20s and in the 30s. Before there was an Israel, before there was a Netanyahu,
yes.
before there was a Meir Kahani, before there was an any
any entity called Israel.
Yes.
They were being slaughtered by Arabs under the calls of the Grand Mufti, who then affiliated with Hitler. Again, before there was an Israel. What did he have to do with Hitler? One thing and one thing only, the dictates of Islam and its inability to allow, tolerate the existence of non-Islam on their part of what they consider their territory, whether it's an inch or a mile or
yes.
8 miles.
Well, let's remember Aryan comes from the Aryan Mountains, mm-hmm. which is the name
yep.
given how Iran
right.
got its name.
Right.
I mean, fundamentally, that's actually kind of the origin story yep. of the anti-Jew
yep.
hatred
yep.
That infested Germany and others. You know, one of the things that's, again, in history that I find really interesting, Saladin, who died fairly young, I think he was about 45 or 48 when he died, likely of dysentery, although he might have been poisoned. It's a real shame he didn't have another few decades, because he was one of the ones that believed that this conflict would only end when the holy places of the Middle East were open to all for peaceful worship and congregation. But he was at odds with many of his generals and his other leaders. When he was killed and moved, you know, then he's no longer there. That more jihadist nature moved forward and really was able to establish itself. And so that's one of the sort of interesting moments in history where things turn maybe on something as simple as a bit of amoeba in your water.
Yeah. Yeah. History can turn based on some amoeba in the water. There's
yeah.
no question about that. You think about how we got certain presidents, too, certain
yeah.
wars. Let me tie two things together, if I can. The Catherine Mayer story of journalism and this conflict. I was gobsmacked. You're a little younger than me, I think. But I was gobsmacked during the original Satanic Versus crisis of 1989 when Salman Rushdie.
Which I remember.
You remember
yeah.
it well.
Yeah.
And how much of the left was unwilling to stand up for Salman Rushdie because they were conflicted.
Right.
They were so conflicted. Well, is it cultural superiority if we say they don't have a right to say that about him? He has a new novel out about his being attacked and
mm-hmm.
stabbed. It's called Knife, I think. They took his eye out.
Yeah, yeah.
Where was the press on this? People don't remember this happened within
Very
the past
recently,
year.
Yeah. yeah, no, it is an incredible blindness that allows the attacks on Israel, the genocide and all these other accusations to persist against the reality of the world.
Yep. Let's come back with a concluding thought, tying it all together. Sam Stone is my guest. We'll be right back. Thanks to Sam Stone for joining us this hour, our second hour today. Sam, it's great having you. Appreciate it. We're going to we usually have you in the third hour on Thursdays, but thanks for working your schedule so we could spend some time with you today and get you in this week. I'm not sure where we go from everything we've talked about from here, but I think I would say this and see if you agree. You may not. People tend to get a little bit overwrought and hysterical when there are reprisals by the West against Islamic terrorism or radicalism. People lost their minds when we took out Qasem Soleimani, and there was a losing of minds when Israel fired into Iran last night. I counsel just relax a little bit. You know, we're weakening the enemy. We're
yes.
not strengthening the enemy. And the truth of the matter is some of this stuff is coming a little too late. They've been attacking us since before there were reprisals. Speaking of embassies and the sanctity of them, Iran's revolutionary calling card was the takeover of a U.S. embassy,
right.
by the way.
Anyway. And the bombing of others.
And the bombing of the Buenos Aires
yeah.
embassy. And yes, yes. So they want Marcus of Queensbury rules
right.
for everyone but themselves.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good fighter, a friend of mine who's a fighter pilot said, fighter pilots don't believe in the Marquess of Queensbury.
Yeah,
rules.
I like it.
Like,
good.
But fundamentally, I think this comes down to a bigger issue, this whole thing with Catherine Marr, with Israel and Iran and all this. To me, it's this simple. And if you have moral clarity, you'll understand exactly where I'm coming from, which I know you do and most of our listeners probably do. But it's this. The truth is an unalloyed good.
Mm-hmm.
Falsehood is evil. And when you allow falsehood to maintain the narrative, to control the narrative, you are allowing evil to spread under its darkness as far as it can go. And the truth in this is that Israel is a good nation, full of good people who want to do good things. And Iran is a bad nation, full of good people who are effectively irrelevant because they are dominated by the falsehoods and lies of their clergy.
Nicely put. Nicely put. Yes, black-winged ghouls flew in to further harm a people that had long been brutally suppressed in 1979.
Yes.
And when we pray for things like the peace of Jerusalem, we should also pray for the liberation of Iran.
Absolutely.
Sam Stone, bless you, sir.
You as well, Seth.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.